Hello, and welcome to the Five Nines of Downtime podcast. Today's guest is Michael Firetag, and we'll be discussing the new Atari VCS. I'm Alex Handy.
And I'm Steve Sullivan.
And stay with us for Five Nines of Downtime.
Spine is a brand new container hosting platform designed to eliminate IT and operations tasks. Spine provides a huge palette of reasonably priced cloud-native services, the same used to scale companies like Twitter and Apple. With the Spine platform, a complex application that would typically require weeks of involved DevOps work can be shipped in under 15 minutes. Quite simply, whether you've got a monolith or microservices, Spine is designed to make your life easier. Let us handle DevOps while you focus on what you do best, building great products that change the world. We're offering an obligation-free $50 credit to prove it to you. Simply sign up at our website, spi.ne. Again, that's spi.ne. Spine, cloud native, at a click.
Welcome back to Such As, our news section here. And we are talking about something a little bit off the topic of enterprise software development today. We're talking about the new Atari VCS.
Yes, indeed. They finally released the tech details, and they're starting to take pre-orders as of the past week or so. And I've got to say, it is an interesting system. It's based on Linux. It's using Ubuntu, and the processor inside it is one of these sort of AMD kind of CPU GPU combos. It's called a Bristol Ridge A1, and it's paired up to a Radeon R7, effectively a GPU core. And I don't know. It seems to me like they're trying to position the Atari VCS to be sort of this platform for distributing indie games, to kind of provide, a platform in the same way the 2600 did. Because, realistically, back in the 70s, indie game development was kind of Atari's bread and butter, and they really built an industry on top of that. And it seems like this is kind of like their attempt to do it in the 21st century.
Well, the first thing to remember here is this has nothing to do with the original Atari. This is literally just like the name and a lot of the copyrights and so forth.
Yeah.
And Atari has been passed around the industry like 7 or 8 times at this point. It is it's nothing to do with the original company. And when the original VCS was launched, they had no interest whatsoever in fostering a development community. Activision was founded by David Crane and some other folks because Atari wasn't paying them enough. And they're like, screw you guys, we're going to go make our own games. And they knew how to make the games work, right?
Well, I think what's notable is that perhaps like the technology in the 70s still wasn't, so it didn't make it so easy to sort of develop copyright, protection chips in the same way that, Nintendo and Sega did for a lot of their systems. Really, you're right in saying that the indie game community that really existed around Atari, for the most part was something that was just an artifact of the fact that you could do that. It was pretty easy and cheap to create an Atari game, even though Atari themselves didn't really, support that. Most of their money off of their own games.
So the actual hardware in the original Atari is I think perhaps the most fascinating piece of computing equipment like ever produced. It is so unbelievably primitive.
Oh,
it is unbelievable that thing is able to do anything it is capable of doing. It literally syncs up every frame with the CPU. So as the TV is refreshing, about 60 hertz. No, it's what a CRT does, 60 hertz, right?
Yeah, so an NTSC CRT will do 60 hertz.
So every 60, 60 times a second, the CPU is being asked 60 times that second, what do I draw here? And for the whole screen, blue dot, green dot. There's no frame buffer. The thing has 10, 24 bits of RAM. There's absolutely no such thing as a frame buffer. You're literally drawing every frame by hand from the CPU. Like, you have to just, make your game into an algorithm.
And, pretty much all the work you can do has to be done in the raster, in the raster interrupt, that little tiny bit of space before one beam draws and the other one. And, I think in a lot of ways that led to you know, sort of a cultivation of this sort of hackerish sort of community because of the inherent limitations of that platform. And there were also some other really interesting cases, like, you know, talking about David Crane, you know, what he did for the Pitfall sequel was that he actually ended up designing custom logic that he slotted in to the bus alongside the controller, rather the cartridge for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's fascinating that, you know, that was also kind of one of the first platforms to allow for, you know, sort of flexible hardware to allow you to, you know, add in chips, kind of like in the same way the Super FX chip was used in the Super Nintendo for games like Star Fox.
Oh, I mean, remember how big these games were. I mean, we're talking about games that don't go over 2 kilobytes.
Yeah, it's so true. And what, you had like 256 bytes of onboard RAM, something ridiculous like that.
1024 bits. So one 1024 bits of RAM on the Atari. That's like not bytes, bits.
Don't spend all those bits in the same place.
So you can actually, if you print out the source code for an Atari game, and this has been done by a gentleman named Ben Fry. If you look them up, they're called Distella Maps. They hung in the New York Museum of Modern Art until they ripped this huge chunk of the Modern Art Museum, the museum out to do a big expansion. Now there's like none of this anymore. But anyway, you actually printed out the source code to Atari 2600 games. And if you print the source code, you can see the art because the art is literally 1 and 0, dot, no dot.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no ASCII. So you're drawing all the letters and numbers and score numbers and so forth in RAM and in the code of the game as well. Like the amount of space that was required to make an Atari game is literally on the order that a human being could memorize it. Like, it wouldn't be easy, but it'd be a damn sight easier than people like who memorize Shakespearean plays.
Yeah.
It'd be like a big sonnet.
I imagine it starts to get a little bit of a rhythm once you have enough, you know, enough memorized. It's like, oh, eight.
Yeah. And so the thing, like, I mean, David Crane, again, the original Pitfall has 256 unique screens. None of them repeat.
It's such a technical accomplishment. Like, David Crane was such a genius. He still is.
He still is. You know, the world is littered with dead attempted consoles. Remember the Ouya?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of folks might potentially leverage that against something like the Atari VCS, because that was really the first, attempt that was at least notable to kind of create a platform explicitly for indie games. And, you know, the Ouya just had, you know, such an anemic processor, and it was extremely kind of overhyped. And the company itself really, I think in a lot of cases, kind of oversold what it could do. It set expectations so high that the system itself could never hope to, you know, to really meet those expectations.
And there was no killer app. There was one game from Kim Swift's company called like Fjord something. It was this Viking themed game. But like, a console is only as good as its anchor titles. I mean, true. I always say this at the museum. I say this to everybody. Like, how many Nintendo consoles do you own? And everybody's like, oh, I owned them all. Okay, name me one game on the Wii that wasn't made by Nintendo. right? Like, the Nintendo first party games are the only reasons to own a Nintendo console. They're that good. Yes. You literally buy the hardware to play them. Like, what's the game on the Atari VCS that is so good that I need to pay, it'll probably be like $100 to get this thing, unplug something from my HDMI port on my TV, because it only has 2 friggin' HDMI ports, and plug this thing in? Like, what's the game that is so compelling that makes me do this?
I mean, one of the things I find amusing is that they kind of advertise that, you know, they'll have like a couple hundred Atari games from the 80s, and it's like, well, you know, I'm sure like all of like the modern gamers today would like love to play like, you know, Missile Command and like Yar's Revenge. Like, those are definitely like some games that modern gamers really have really fits their sensibilities.
It just doesn't seem to me that I need to pay $100 to play those, right? Like, I can go to the thrift store and buy an Atari pack, or I can buy like that little joystick that you plug into the RCA ports and put some batteries in with the Atari games. And plus, you know, there's only about like 10 Atari games that still hold up today.
And, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges about, you know, sort of relying on developers to bring games to the platform is that it means that there's, you know, a pretty significant delay between, you know, the platform existing and then having there be like a true reason for a consumer to buy it, you know, beyond like you know, the Atari name, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I think in a lot of ways, the sort of company that is called Atari was doing this Indiegogo, not necessarily because they didn't have the money, but to kind of gauge market interest.
Oh yeah. It's a hedge. Why would you invest any money when you can just have some yokel throw you money first?
It's kind of the Indiegogo kind of platform, really.
Right? Yeah. But at the end of the day, I think it still comes down to the games. And you're absolutely right. If you want to have an indie dev scene, you have to have a dev kit. And where's the dev kit? And when are these people building? If they're just building games for Linux, because that doesn't sound like that's going to be very successful. I mean,
I don't know about you, but Tux Racer, I mean, that's...
So a number of years ago, there was actually a firm that put out these DVDs, and they were bootable Linux DVDs, and they would boot into Linux and then load shit like Tux Racer, one game per disc.
Oh, cool. That seems like a pretty good use of a DVD right there.
Yeah, I think I donated them to the museum, but it was just like, what are you thinking? I mean, I get the idea. This is a really cool tech and this is a good demonstration, but nobody's playing to pay Tux Racer to play Tux Racer. Like,
I mean, you know, I think Linux, there isn't really anything like holding Linux back these days in terms of being like a good, you know, platform for games. I mean, admittedly, like the NVIDIA and ATI drivers, you know, that are proprietary tend to still be extremely unstable. But, you know, if you had a company around that, you can make that like less terrible. I guess it'd be all right.
It's called Transmeta.
Oh, yeah. Transmeta.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the, you know, the wine and stuff. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's nothing really holding it too far back. OpenGL is you know, just fine under Linux. Mm-hmm. But again, it comes down to like, what are the good games? You know what I always think of as Wolfenstein Enemy Territory. That's a great Linux game, but it's ancient and there's no servers.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people who use Linux, I mean, for the most part, probably don't game on Linux.
Right? Yeah, no, why would you?
You know, most of my friends that I know who you know, heavy Unix, well, Unix or Linux users like myself, they tend to, you know, just dual boot into Windows. And, you know,
there is a Steam for Linux, and you can play Dota 2 under Linux. And there's a bunch of games that work under Linux, but it's just, yeah, exactly. Why bother, right? Like, Windows is what is expected.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you know, projects like the Atari VCS and also things like the Steam Box, you know, seem to be these attempts at kind of pushing Linux into the living room providing a platform. But, you know, I really do have to agree with you that without there being a compelling like launch title that makes somebody want to buy the system itself, you know, you have your early adopters, and that's what we're certainly seeing in the market here. But I really can't see it catching on with consumers in general without having there be a hook, because, you know, it's like a $300 system, $200, I think, without a controller. And that's
$200.
Yeah, man, it's pretty expensive.
Forget it. I'll buy a cheap old PC and plug it into my TV. Anyway, we should be moving on to our interview section. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Getting Weird With It section here on Five Nines of Downtime. Today's guest is Michael Feiertag, co-founder of T-Cell. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you tell us about T-Cell?
Sure. So we're a startup based in San Francisco, and what we do is we've got a service for any company that's building and deploying web apps or API service. So they're deploying software, and our job is to help make sure that our customers applications don't get hacked by outsiders. So we're there to protect it in a production environment. So, you know, we're particularly focused on the teams and companies that are trying to adopt newer approaches to building software. You know, let's say they're adopting cloud services, they're trying to get DevOps working, and they're trying to figure out how to make security fit into that environment where they're innovating really quickly and security teams are falling behind. That's where T-Cell comes in. We help the security teams catch up and actually kind of get ahead of the game as new software shipped out. We make sure it's secure and they know, are you under attack? Who's attacking you? How are they doing it? Are they making progress? And ultimately, we can help shut down the attackers and protect the apps.
So bringing software security into the web application layer, you know, with the speed of the iteration that takes place there, how are you able to keep up with sort of the demands of the DevOps agile environment?
Yeah, good question. So there's a couple answers to that. So starting with sort of the basic philosophy, which is the in kind of the old world. So my background was that before doing T-Cell with my co-founder, Boris, I was at Okta running product management, and before that running products at Blue Coat Systems back when it was independent. And Blue Coat, you know, is an old school security company. And what we saw there was, you know, we had tools for our customers that basically helped our customers tell their teams how to stop doing things, right? So we had a box that would go on the, you know, the internet, a gateway to the internet, and it became essentially the control point to limit access to the internet to kind of business appropriate things. And that was kind of one of the principal functions. So with T-Cell, we have a very, very different approach to security. So the philosophy that we built the product around is instead of giving a control point that helps security people stop things from happening, it's a control point that essentially opens gates up to make it possible to do things, but you know, basically give them a way to say yes, subject to the controls that they need to have in place, right? So there's the philosophy difference. So then from a technology perspective, what we've done is something very different than what you would do with a blocking device, right? What we have is a little bit of software that we give our customers. So everything's pure software backed by a cloud service. And it's basically like a little agent that would drop onto any part of the app that makes sense that needs to be protected. So it could be at the, you know, proxy layer. So in, you know, Nginx, Apache, IIS, drop in there. There are, you know, little agents that can drop into the software itself, you know, running at the language level, Java, .NET, you know, and so forth, Python, and what have you. But basically what's going to happen is with T-Cell, when the agent's in place, we'll hook into the running application, and it gives us visibility into what's actually happening as your users interact with the application. So we'll see the traffic coming into the application, but we'll also see the app starting to execute. We'll see it sending queries to databases, accessing the operating system. We can see what's going on inside the browser as it executes. And effectively what happens is it gives you a clear view as a security person into how the app normally operates, and then a clear view into any things that it does that it shouldn't do, right? So, you know, sending weird commands to the operating system, running bad scripts in the browser, pulling in malicious content from a third-party location. You can see all of this happening, and you can do it without calling a meeting or adding a process to the release cycle or doing anything that would slow down shipping software. It gives you visibility into how the application is operating both normally and abnormally without requiring developers or operations people to collect that information for you and stop what they're doing to give you that information. And then if you find something that shouldn't be there, right? So let's say you discover that the, you know, app is sending information to something that would violate a privacy policy, or you see that the application, like a bad guy's found a vulnerability and they're trying, you know, they're getting it to execute, you know, queries to the database that shouldn't go or anything like that, you can then implement controls into the application that stop that from happening. And again, do it without requiring developers or operations people to do that for you. You can essentially slot in with them, and just like an operations guy can see this sort of thing from a performance perspective, with a tool like New Relic Rapid Dynamics, they would see this sort of thing happening from a security perspective, and then be able to control it. So roughly speaking, that's how it works. So lightweight software, don't change any code, don't change the infrastructure, and get visibility into what's going on inside the app, but do it in a way that doesn't cause work for people outside of your organization, outside of your teams.
Interesting. It seems like coming out of Okta, you sort of could have gone any way you wanted. You had a lot of opportunities. Why was this such an enticing space to move into? Is there really a huge need here?
Oh, it's critical. So it's like, I mean, it comes from, if you think about it, basically every company out there is building and deploying software, right? So it's not just the tech companies anymore, right? You can go, you know, it's the, you know, it, you know, every financial services company in the world, every media company, like every manufacturing company, everyone's trying to build and deploy software, and they're trying to do it faster and faster because their competitors are. And whoever can innovate more quickly with software tends to win, right? And that goes across everything, right? So that's the starting point. But then what we saw is like, what are the big obstacles to doing this well? Well, there's been huge investment and great innovation in the actual building of software, right? So, led by Amazon and the tool sets that built on top of that, all the big data, so like all these different things to build better and kind of and more effective software and do it in a way that's been very democratized. That's happened. But what Boris and I saw, and Boris is my co-founder, so he was a VP engineering at Splunk, before we got together to do this. So he would see this for people trying to shoehorn Splunk to solve certain problems. And I saw this at Okta kind of internally trying to solve these sorts of problems. What we saw is that we were getting better and better at building software faster, but frankly, worse and worse at securing that software. And so the real need from the market to actually be able to take true advantage of all these kind of new tools that are available was not necessarily have a better development environment or better, build environment, better, production environment to run it in. It was, how do you make sure that when you do that, you've done it in a way that's secure so that you don't have this artificial break to innovation that's caused by legacy security tools, legacy security techniques. And so that's why we decided to focus on this, because it's just like, it is the problem, not just in the security world, application security, but really it's like the problem to, unlocking your ability to move quickly with software.
Yeah, one of the traditional problems I've seen in this area with the static code analysis market was that the budget for security tends to fall on the operations side of the house and not on the development side of the house. Certainly there's groups that do have the budget on the development side, like they get it. But traditionally, like their budget on the development side is for tools and services and so forth. How do you see this coming down into a budget inside of
the house? Yeah, that's a good question. And because we're focused on protecting that production environment, we tend to fall inside that operations budget, security operations budget, which, frankly, is a good thing. It makes life a little easier for us. The other side of that we've seen is that the traditional kind of stack of where people are spending their budget dollars on production security, so on operational security, is shifting pretty dramatically. So if you were to go back, 5 years or however many years, and you talk to a CISO about where he spends his money, it'll generally will mirror what the CIO brags about spending their money on. So the CIO will brag about how they've got like the biggest Cisco network in the world, and like, they're Dell's second biggest customer, and then there's some side, and then the lines of businesses install some software off on the side. And then the CIO or CISO would often kind of mirror that in the sense that, I have the best firewalls in the world. I'm on Palo Alto's customer advisory board, and I've also got great endpoint protection. I've got kind of like cutting edge stuff that's going there, and I'm advising some companies on that. And then, there's some application security stuff going with the web app firewall on top of that. It's kind of a sideshow. So these days, starting with the CIO, what do they brag about? Well, no one brags about the network they've got, right? They brag about how small, little network they've got and how dynamic they've made their servers, where they're not buying servers anymore. It's all going into, public cloud, and it's being totally dynamic. But what they're really going to brag about is how many software developers they have and how much software that they're cranking out to support their business. And that shift happened years ago. And so but just now, security folks are starting to catch up with this, where CISOs are starting to brag about the same thing, right? They're not bragging about what network security controls they have in place. They're starting to brag, hey, I've got cloud infrastructure protections, but then even more importantly, I've got protections in place for the software that's getting built out, right? And so I'm building out the best production application security program in the world, and I hired these great great people to lead that. That's what we're starting to see. So if the budgets stay in that production world, but they're also kind of like the pyramid sort of shifting from a low-level infrastructure emphasis, which is what you did when you were running colos, to a software and dynamic infrastructure, you know, cloud infrastructure emphasis. And so there tend to be parallels between individual items. Web app firewall budget becomes this kind of next generation thing, next generation cloud WAF, next generation runtime application self-protection. And then the others sort of come along, but they're somewhat different, and the emphasis shifts enormously up the stack from what it used to be. At least that's what we're seeing.
Interesting. That is a major shift. It's funny you point out we're Dell's biggest customer or something like that as a bragging point.
Yeah, now it's embarrassing if you say that, right? That's
it's a total shift. I don't think anybody could have predicted that, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what's the future of this market then, if this is the major shift? Where is this all going? I mean, web application firewalls have been around for a little while now. So what's the future of this market?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So the reality of security markets tend to follow underlying infrastructure markets. So in this case, what's happening is that customers are looking for security solutions that will fit into correctly into their new world, which is both an infrastructure thing, public cloud, and it's a operational kind of social thing, DevOps, right? And so the future of the market ends up being, what is the right way to solve the old problems? Am I under attack? Is the attack successful? What do I do about it at the application layer? But how do I solve that in the new way that works best and leverages the new tools that are available rather than the old on-prem proxy techniques of a web app firewall? So what you'll see is, it might be called the WAF market, might be called the next-gen WAF market, might be called the RAS market. There's lots of words that are floating around here, but basically there's a solution for protecting production applications. It starts pulling the best elements of technologies from these kind of different worlds, some things from the old world. So there'll be web app firewall type capabilities that move into the new worlds. And even Amazon and Azure have kind of built that into some of their components. So that starts to become available. It will start to leverage new things that are available because it's in this new environment. So, pulling ideas from the application performance management world, like New Relic and AppDynamics. It will cover all the problems that are relevant today, not just the problems that were relevant 5-10 years ago. So bot mitigation becomes incredibly important in addition to, vulnerability, blocking for specific vulnerabilities. And all of it gets built in a different way to support this different release model, right? So it becomes pure software, it becomes automatable. It just works the way people build and deploy software today, just like the old world of racking a box worked well when the way you deployed applications was you racked a bunch of Dell boxes. All that shifts over, but the common themes actually stay very, very similar, right? Make a list of what are your possible attacks, right, that are relevant today, and those change, but there is a list. Pick the right technologies to identify and block those attacks, subject to the most important thing, which is they're highly deployable by the operations teams that you have to partner with, and make sure that they're cost effective. They scale the way your applications will scale, and they just work. They work right based on the technologies and methodologies they're using today. So that's where things are going.
Interesting. I'm going to hand you over to Steve now and see what sort of fun technical questions he has.
So, hey, how's it going? Immediately, my first question to you is: reading through your documentation, it looks like your technology works by integrating with the current sort of web application framework that a end user might be using, something like Tomcat or Flask or Ruby on Rails, sends telemetry back to your servers. Am I correct about that?
That's correct. That's correct.
And so then you're able to perform sort of like a threat analysis from that telemetry data?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can do. So what'll happen is with that telemetry from, web server tier, from the application tier, there's actually little bits of JavaScript, and use something called a content security policy header that it'll give us visibility that's happening at what's happening inside the browser itself. So from those three points, we'll asynchronously collect information about, you know, how the application's operating. So initially, for example, there'll be a kind of a discovery phase where you as a security person are trying to understand the risk profile of the application, like what third-party libraries got loaded in, and we'll map that to know, to tell you whether there are known CVEs against them. So kind of, you have vulnerable libraries, we'll tell you what API endpoints have been exposed to the outside world. So it's like a netstat, but at the application layer, and to tell you, instead of telling you what ports are opened up, we'll tell you what APIs are opened up. And the browser side will tell you what scripts are in there, but even more importantly, we'll tell you what third-party domains are being loaded along with your application. So you're pulling content from Akamai, are you pulling images from Google, fonts from any other place, and is that, you know, is that appropriate? So you'll get this discovery phase. Then the next thing you'll see is how people start accessing the application in a normal way, right? So you'll see, you know, again, from these hooks, you'll see, you know, what endpoints do get accessed, what, you know, databases get accessed, what content gets pulled in, what, so what's actually happening when people use the application, right? And so, and then pretty quickly, if you're on the internet, you're going to start, you know, someone will start poking at you and see if they can find it, and they'll start hacking it. And you'll start identifying that. So you'll see malicious payloads coming in. You'll see bots that might be targeting your authentication controllers to see, to look for, you know, hits on a username password they might have stolen from somewhere else. So you'll start seeing malicious activity against the application, which is very interesting. But then because it's got those hooks inside of the application, it can see which of these attacks that are happening are resulting in an actual breach or not an actual exploit. So, you know, of the, you know, 100,000 command injection payloads that were thrown at your application through some bot over, you know, the course of a week, did any of them result in a shell command that got executed by the application? In most cases, the answer will be no. But if you have a vulnerability, your own vulnerability or a vulnerability from a library that you loaded in that opened that up, if you leave it open, if you leave it there for long enough, you don't react to someone attacking, they're going to find the hole. And this would give you the ability to see that happening. And then the last phase is, okay, well, you'll have policies in place that prevent the app from doing something it shouldn't do, right? So let's say that example, someone throws in that payload, they figure out how to get it to run some shell command. Well, your policy would say my app doesn't run shell commands because most don't. And so it would stop that. So, and that would prevent the catastrophic breach from there. So the control, so you've discovered the risk of their application, you've seen the attacks are happening, you've separated the breaches from the attacks, but you've got policies in place that the agents are able to enforce server side, net, you know, proxy side, browser side, to stop any attacker from making real progress and breaching the application.
Interesting. That reminds me a little bit of writing, say, an SE Linux policy to deny certain kinds of privileges from an application.
That's exactly right. So it's just thinker. So if you picture how life is these days, where, you know, you're going serverless, like you're, you know, the vast majority of the attack surface area of your, you know, environment is exposed by the application itself. There's a lot of analogies of what you used to do, or you still do, but what you do at that host layer, in terms of, you know, controlling, you know, what individual processes are allowed to do, what, you know, ports are opened up, things like that. What's the equivalent at the app layer, where there's so much more complexity, which translates to so much more risk? Like, what do you do there, right? So, and you want to set up a similar level of controls and visibility to actually protect there, because that's basically where that's where all your exposure is these days.
Makes perfect sense. That sounds really interesting, especially how you can sort of do a discovery of different kinds of threat vectors and other sorts of bits of normal, you know, normal usage of your application, and then apply these kinds of, you know, remediating policies to ensure that if the worst really does come to the worst, that, you know, the impact can be quite low. So kind of along this sort of idea, you know, I was curious because, you know, since we're sending information to the T-cell, you know, to the T-cell servers, and some of the information coming from a web app might include, you know, privileged information, you know, mm-hmm. the terms of like the, you know, HIPAA or PCI or something like the GDPR in particular. I was wondering how T-Cell is able to ensure the security of the data itself that's being sent to the servers.
Sure. Yeah, that's a critical thing to make sure you have right with any product like ours. So there's a couple layers to this. So, I mean, the starting course is that we've got to be obsessive about the security of our service, right? And of course, we are, and do all the right certifications around, you know, SOC 2 certification, get PCI, all that good stuff. Now, beyond that, there's specific product functionality you want to have to give people clear visibility into what data is being sent up to the service. And so there's obviously like clear documentation around this, but then beyond that, there's modes where you can, you know, tee off the data, inspect, and see exactly what's going there. Then on top of that, you want to make sure that the data is handled correctly, right? And so that starts with ensuring that encryption happens, you know, everywhere that it needs to happen. So obviously the transport layer, data's, you know, encrypted at rest. When it's encrypted, it goes into a multi-tenant cloud service, but the encryption is, the keys are, you know, per tenant, so there's no way to they have data leaking between, you know, one tenant and another or anything like that, or having, you know, T-Cell employees don't have access to your data, like all that sort of taken care of through the encryption mechanisms. And then the last step is you do have, because you have very clear visibility in what data is going up to the service, you can be very selective about it. So you can decide what data you do want to share up to the service and what you don't. Now, everything you send up then adds value to, you know, identifying attacks, understanding your application, and so forth. So in the end, it's, you know, there's a strong incentive to sending all kinds of information up there. But that said, there are going to be certain things you never want to send. And, you know, but for everyone, like, for instance, a password would never, you know, that someone types into an authentication form, of course, would never get sent up to the service. But there may be specific items that you have that are, you know, more business logic specific, and you want to have controls over that, and we'll give you the ability to do that. So it's handle the data correctly, make sure it's encrypted, and then give clear visibility into it, and then ultimately give controls over what do you want to send up to the cloud service and what do you want to keep local.
Interesting. So you mentioned that T-Cell employees, for the most part, won't be able to get at the information that's sent to those servers. Does that mean that every customer has their own custom encryption key for the data at rest?
They do. There's it's a kind of typical mechanism that a lot of these SaaS companies use. So there's a common key, and then we generate a separate key per a tenant that's used to encrypt each of the tenants that's stored separately. It's for the average employee, meaning like anyone except for a couple ops people, that's the end of it. It's not physically possible for them to then get access. What we still maintain the private key. So we haven't added that additional feature that some of the, you know, companies like Box have added and will probably add in the future, where we let our customers manage a private key. So that's kind of like the next step of where this could go. But today what'll happen is there's a key for each customer that's stored in a separate encrypted database that's programmatically accessed, and it's, you know, it's no employees gets direct access to that, but it's still managed by us. And then the next step would be having a kind of external key server that a customer would manage.
Makes perfect sense. Very cool. That's indeed a quite a good security practice that you maintain there by providing that feature to your customers. So I'd like to change gears a little bit and talk a little bit about sort of the inspiration behind not only T-Cell, but, you know, your career in general. And one of the questions we like to ask to kind of get this process started on Five Nines is to ask you what your first computer was.
Oh, my first computer. My first computer was a Mulder. So it was a IBM PC XT with 256K memory and dual 5 1/4 floppies. And it was awesome.
That's a hot rod right there. So, you know, what kind of led you into the field of development, and particularly into the field of network and application security?
Yeah, it's interesting. So my career took a bit of a meandering path. So I started, I actually studied math in college and graduate school. I was going to be a math professor. And then, when I was in my PhD program, I decided that, you know, ultimately it took me a shocking amount of time to figure this out, but I realized that that just wasn't for me. It was too far from the practical value that I thought that I really wanted to focus on. So these are, you know, these beautiful abstract ideas, but you know, four people in the world would understand what you were actually doing, and that's not what I wanted to do. And so I left, and this was actually the tail end of 2000. So it was at the, you know, back in the bubble days, it was the tail end of that. And I moved out. My sister actually had me living in San Francisco, and I moved out to Silicon Valley. I knew how to program a computer based on, you know, my personal interests and math background. And I just kind of fell into software engineering initially. And then after just a couple of years, what I realized is that I loved interacting with customers as much as writing software, and I loved solving their problems. And I was at a kind of early stage startup where we needed some more product direction, and I kind of moved into product management there. And I spent most of my career on product management. It's been all kinds of different products. So it was, you know, started off with networking proxy products. And I have a, you know, there's something that's actually on a big IP right now that I kind of worked on, the web accelerator product. Then I went to Blue Coat and managed all their products at some point. And so got into, you know, networking, into security, kind of learned all these different areas, mostly infrastructure, and then ran products at Okta where, you know, it was still infrastructure, but I, you know, kind of fell in love with this concept of cloud and basically making things easier for our customers and for helping them adopt technologies faster and better, which is ultimately what Okta was about and is about. And it also was frankly the same inspiration for T-Cell, which is that, you know, I saw, you know, if Okta was about helping enterprises adopt SaaS, then, you know, T-Cell is like our part of helping companies and teams adopt cloud and just generally adopt faster methods of innovating with software and doing our part of doing that. And so that was kind of the inspiration. I was looking at what are the bottlenecks for helping a company like, you know, at the time, Okta move faster. And as a product manager, one of the major obstacles was, well, we got to make sure it's secure. And like, we could go a lot faster if we didn't have to worry about that. And the tools that were available to us to make sure the software was secure and the methodologies that were available to us were not good. They were nowhere near as good as the operational tools that I saw were available. And so that was the ultimate inspiration. It was to solve this problem that had been, the parallel problem had been solved in the operations world incredibly well. And I just saw the security realm, which I had been a part of earlier in my career at Blue Coat, was just lagging. And, you know, it just kind of kept bothering me. And then I talked to Boris, and he was had seen at Splunk, you know, his customers trying to cobble together kind of crazy solutions based on his product to solve these sorts of problems. And it was too hard. And we thought about it and we kind of realized, well, there's a way better way to do this, both culturally and technically. And that was kind of the inspiration to go for a T-Cell.
That's quite a journey right there from
yeah,
the field of security. And, you know, you're so right. The field of security really has been lagging, especially in the era of web scale and, you know, having to adapt to, you know, a new world where internet technology and particularly mobile technology are ubiquitous. So that's fascinating. And T-Cell really does seem like a really fantastic product. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
And be sure to stay tuned for more Five Nines of Downtime.
The Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment is a nonprofit 501c3 video game museum located in downtown Oakland. The MADE hosts all playable exhibits of over 5,000 games across 40 different systems, featuring home computer and console gaming. The MADE also undertakes preservation work, as it has with NeoHabitat.org, the first MMO for C64, and its work to preserve fair use exemptions to the DMCA. For more information, check out themade.org. Donate your time or equipment today.
That's it for this week's edition of the Five Nines of Downtime podcast. Remember, you can find us online in Google Play or on Apple Music and even on SoundCloud. Be sure to thank our sponsors, Spine and the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment. We're always weird. We're always silly. Please don't send clams to our homes if you think we're wrong about something. Just let us know with a friendly email to alexhandy@gmail.com or steve@getspine.co. As we close today, it's time for Milliseconds of Nano Silliness, which we could use some help on if you want to email us some ideas for these. Today's topic is bad synth pop band names.
That's a good question. How about Toilet Mode? It's kind of a band that you engage only when heading to the bathroom and needing to relieve yourself.
How about Axel Foley's Armpit? It's a live performance acoustic tribute band to Harold Faltermeyer.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Also, like, I think that almost leads to Harold Faltermeyer. I think that
of course. Yes, and if we come up with any more silly names next week, we will let you know about them here on the Five Nines of Downtime podcast.